reaching from way down here.
Yeah.
From way down here.
Welcome to Thread, a podcast designed to explore God's story and lead you into a full life in Christ.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation, co-hosted by myself, Hannah D'Souza, and Dr. David Pachter.
Though I'm way down here, I get a better view of this boundless world that I'm going to.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Thread. We are in our last episode of this series, God's Nation Formed. And today we are talking about culture and the culture of Israel. There's a quote by the Jamaican activist Marcus Garvey, who said, "A people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots," which was a quote we both liked that kind of speaks to the importance of culture. So I guess I can ask you, Dave, to begin, how would you define culture and why is it important?
Yeah, culture. I mean, that the reason that quote is so powerful is we often hear that about history, right? If we don't know our history, we're bound to repeat it. History is really important. Culture is really important as well, because culture really defines, as we're going to find out today, how we process the world around us and what we value. So when we think about culture, I thought it would be helpful today to kind of go through this in three steps. So we'll do a little bit on just definitions. What is it? Why is it important? And then we'll talk about Israel itself, what shaped Israel's culture. And then we'll end today with conversation about culture today and how these lessons kind of apply to our spirituality. So that's the ambitious plan today. Are you and Gilgamesh okay with that?
Well, we're ready.
We'll okay. Guys. So culture, at its most basic level, is the shared characteristics of a group. So those are all kinds of various things. Our values or beliefs or attitudes about life and about purpose and about how we function in the world, our expectations or standards or norms and how we think about life and life around us. Culture actually gets into, and I think what's really important with culture is a lot of the symbols that we have. So money is a symbol. We don't always think about that, but what makes this little piece of paper with the 100 on it have a value? That's a symbol of our culture. Art, of course, is very symbolic of culture. And probably the most influential is language. And we touch on that here and there, even in this podcast, when we talk about the Hebrew language or the Greek language. When you start getting into language, you start realizing words are actually symbols that connect with meaning. And so that's why language is so important. But as this podcast is so, I think, well defined, that story and narrative is really critical at shaping culture. So again, we often don't remember that these stories were told orally for generations, and they weren't written down and edited the way that we have them in the scriptures until they'd been being told for a long time. And so the way that those stories shape the way we think about things, and that's why we tell stories, that's why we tell our children's stories. They shape aspects of culture that we pass on to the next generation. It tells us who our heroes are. It tells us even who our enemies are in our stories. So we also get into things like rituals, like how we practice things, religious practices, which we'll get into a lot today with Israel. They're all really important. So I did find this quote from James Spradley, I think is his name. He was an anthropologist, that is a really good kind of definition. Hannah, maybe you could read this quote for us. It's a good definition of what we're trying to express.
Culture is the acquired knowledge people use to interpret experience and generate behavior.
Yeah, so when you think about that, it's an acquired knowledge. So that's important. Mm-hmm. It's something that we together learn, and it's how we interpret what we're experiencing. So how do we give meaning to these experiences? The other thing that he says in this is it also generates behavior. And we'll talk just a little bit about how culture even shapes the way we think about things. So, for example, culture all share in these basic features. So one of the things that Spradley defines is that culture is learned. It's not biological, right? So we enculturate our children from the time they're born, and we teach them about what we value. Culture is something we share. It's a communal thing. It's a sociological component, not an individual one. So our culture really is defined by this community that surrounds us and whatever that is. Culture is based on symbols. We've talked about that already. It's integrated. In other words, there's multiple pieces about culture, but they're all somehow interconnected. And when you start pulling on one of the threads, you start realizing the way that it's connected to all these other pieces. But it's also dynamic. It changes, right? There's no such thing as a fixed culture that remains. And we know that because of scripture. I mean, even when we look at these stories that are 3,000 years old, or we start looking at Jesus from 2,000 years ago, we go, wow, the culture was really different from what we experience today. And that's part of what we're trying to bring out here today, Hannah, is this idea that when we read the Bible, we're stepping into another culture. And when we even look at each other, I think that's one of the things that's interesting about doing a podcast with you growing up in the UK. You're from a different culture.
Yeah.
I was teasing Hannah about how she pronounced something as we were getting ready for this episode.
Yes, it was the quote from the start, Marcus Garvey.
Marcus, yes.
Yeah.
But that's part of culture, right? Even how we speak and communicate to one another. So all of that's important in those basic features, but culture also informs how we think about things in our community. So class is an example. You know, we like to believe in America we don't have classism, but we look at other cultures and see that there was classism. What does that mean? That you're born into a certain stratus of society that you're expected to live and function in, all right? I was just reading a book called The Covenant of Water, and it's a beautiful description of life in India starting in the year 1900. And the classism that exists in India is just demonstrated throughout the book. And so that's really defined by culture. Race is defined by culture and ethnicity. Now, those tend to be different. But how we think about someone from a different culture, someone with a different color of skin, someone from a different origin is shaped by culture. How we think about gender is shaped by culture, and how we think about our age is shaped by culture. For example, there are cultures that really value wisdom in the elder community, and then there's cultures that tend to value youth. And so that's often defined by culture. So one of the things that's interesting is how slogans or mottos often capture culture or cultural truths. So I would say, you know, even you can think about even in the United States, right? So of course, I was born in 1969. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. I was raised in Boise, Idaho. I was raised in a Catholic cultural context, religiously. My father, as I mentioned in an early episode, grew up on a farm. And so one of the cultural motives, mottos or slogans that was common in our family was work hard, play hard. Now, work hard, play hard could just be a motto, but in our family, it actually defined the way we functioned, right? We watched my dad worked hard. And when he played hard. And my mom as well. And we were taught that. So a motto like that actually communicates something that's true of the culture. We come out of a tradition called the Stone Campbell Heritage, right? And you just wrote a paper about the Stone Campbell Heritage. And one of the quotes that you brought up, a slogan in our own history, was one that was from the 19th century. It says, "We are Christians only, but not the only Christians," right? So that defines the way we think about ourselves and how we position ourselves with other people. One of the other slogans that's popular in the Stone Campbell Heritage is we call Bible things by Bible names. And certainly for any of us that have grown up in this Stone Campbell Heritage, we would go, oh yeah, we do that. We call Bible things by Bible names. So that's kind of a general definition of culture. So I want to get into Israel. When we think about Israel and we're thinking about Israel's culture, one of the easiest ways to think about this is to just ask the question, what makes Israel? And you could do that with your family or my family. What makes a D'Souza a D'Souza? Or what makes a Pachta a Pachta? And you start then getting into, okay, now I know what to talk about here with the culture of the D'Souza family or the Pachta family. But when we're talking about defining Israel's culture, that's the question, right? What makes Israel, Israel? So what shaped Israel's culture?
So we had this diagram up in, I think it was our episode on wilderness, where we kind of contrasted the culture that Israel had in Egypt versus what was then cultivated in the wilderness. And of course, we spoke about them having 40 years in the wilderness, which radically would have changed them as a nation, but also was really a time that we've seen God, Yahweh, creating a culture in them. And some things that we've mentioned that you can see in this diagram here. So they emerged out of the wilderness with a much more developed faith. Spiritual leadership was now embedded into their nation. Of course, they have freedom that they didn't have before. They're now self-governing. They've developed their own law. They have a structured military. And again, in terms of their faith, they now had, I guess, a new understanding of dependence on Yahweh. And I think that the daily manna would have definitely helped to enforce that. And I know we'll get more into some of the other cultural aspects that we've kind of discussed in this first portion of this episode when it comes to kind of festivals and things that were also instituted in the wilderness. But those are some of the things I think that kind of came about in those 40 years that were really culturally defining for Israel as a people.
Yeah, there's so much that shaped the culture of Israel. And that's a lot of what we see take place, as you mentioned, here in those 40 years. So we want to articulate a few of those things that get even more specific. So we've talked a lot about their story. Of course, Israel's history, their origin story, how they came out of Egyptian slavery, you know, all of that is really important. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but a lot of the Old Testament was actually written down in the exile many years later. As I said earlier, a lot of the stories were told orally. And the reason it was important to write it down during the exile is they started realizing, okay, we're now no longer in this land and we have to kind of capture the narrative of what really matters and what made us us. So that's even important, right? So this passage in Deuteronomy 6 that I want to have you read in a minute is a really good demonstration, because Yahweh actually tells Israel, when you pass this on to your kids, how do you frame this story? How do you explain what makes Israel, Israel, right? In using the language that we're using. And so Yahweh even gave them the way to answer the question. If you could read Deuteronomy 6, 20 to 25.
In the future, when your son asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord our God has commanded you? Tell him, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, the Lord sent signs and wonders, great and terrible, on Egypt and Pharaoh and his whole household. But he brought us out from there to bring us in and give us the land he promised on oath to our ancestors. The Lord commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God, so that we might always prosper and be kept alive, as is the case today. And if we are careful to obey all this law before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us, that will be our righteousness.
There's so much captured there, right?
I think we talked about this in the story of our faith.
We did.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so now, how does this shape culture? Well, it helps the story remain pertinent to the next generation of the key elements, right? This is all about Yahweh. Our salvation came from Yahweh. We were delivered with this miraculous mighty hand. We received our freedom, you know, the things you just talked about here. And that obedience is an important part of the covenantal relationship, so that we can remain righteous. We talked about that even in the tabernacle episode, right? This sense of what does it really mean to be holy or righteous and stay in a proper relationship with Yahweh. So yeah, that's a critical component to remember the story. So we also have other things that shape this. the geography. Geography shapes your culture, where you live, right? They were farmers, shepherds. They maintained vineyards later. Of course, probably not in the desert or the wilderness, but that shapes even the stories. Like when Jesus comes and he tells a story of the vineyard or the vineyard keeper, there's a reason he can tell that story, because it's part of their culture, right? So even, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we learn who the heroes should be. And one of the things you see repeated in the Old Testament is, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, the repetition tells us who to pay attention to. We pay attention to Abraham. We pay attention to Isaac. We pay attention to Jacob. And that becomes other figures as well, Moses and David and others that we're told to pay attention to. So when we think about things like, well, what made Israel's value system? What shaped their attitudes or beliefs? We look at the law or the priesthood, as we talked in one of the previous episodes. How do we understand symbolism? How does that shape Israel being Israel? We've talked about the Hebrew language some already, but even the last episode on the tabernacle, that artistic or aesthetic expression of God's presence and the importance that each of those elements played and those symbols shaped their culture, right? And then one of the things we haven't really spent a lot of time on, we touched on this in the Seasons and Rhythms episode very, very early on, I think like episode 5 or 6, is we started talking a little bit about rituals and rhythms and seasons, and Yahweh built that in, and that really starts to take root at this place in the story, that they had weekly rhythms, the weekly Sabbath, so they were to work 6 days and rest. That was modeled in the creation account itself. It was commanded by Yahweh. And we're given a multiple reasons, and I actually picked a few verses here, Hannah, that I think would be helpful to read that kind of talk about the importance of how Sabbath shaped culture, because the Sabbath really was one of the things that made Israel different from the nations around them, was the practice of Sabbath. So I've got 3 there, if you don't mind reading those.
Yeah, so Exodus 20 verse 8 says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Exodus 23 verse 12 says, 6 days you shall do your work, but on the 7th day you shall rest, so that your ox and your donkey may have relief, and your homeborn slave and the resident alien may be refreshed. And then Deuteronomy 5:15 says, remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day.
You see how the same stories are embedded even in the rituals, right? Mm. We remember the Sabbath day because God rested. So it reminds us of our creation story. We remember it because we were slaves in Egypt. And so we take this moment and reflect. So the narrative, the story is embedded even in their rituals. And we see that with the festivals too. So that's the weekly rhythm. And then there were these annual festivals. There were 3 major ones. Now, what's interesting about these festivals is how Yahweh connects agriculture, the natural rhythms of a year or seasonal kind of movements, and religious kind of memorials, things that we were to reflect on. And so we see that these appointed festivals, they're also called holy convocations in the Bible, because they were trying to tie all these elements together, that there was a seasonal rhythm that flowed, but that it also tied into important things that they were to remember. So there was 3 major festivals at this point. Now, this is pre-exile. We'll see later after the exile that there's an additional celebration or two. But this at this point in their story, we have these 3 major festivals: the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles.
Do you think you could share briefly what kind of they consisted of? I feel like I see those names a lot and don't always know how they differed from each other.
Briefly is the key word there, right? You know, it's kind of confusing too, because there's different things that we see that pop up. Like, wait, what about Passover? Where did that fit in? And, you know, so a lot of these, there's a lot of overlap. So I think the easiest way to think about this, when we think about these seasonal rhythms, is there was a spring festival, a summer festival, and a fall festival. Okay. The spring festival was called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And it was celebrated in the spring as the first fruits of the barley harvest started showing. It began with the Passover. So Passover is part of this week-long celebration of unleavened bread. And the Passover itself, we talked about, which was this kind of memorial of God passing over, the destroying angel passing over Israel because of the blood painted on the door frame of the house. And then part of that celebration was that they were to not have bread with leaven, representing this significance of how quickly they had to get out of Egypt, right? So the unleavened bread represented that they had to leave Egypt in haste. So what happens is they celebrate Passover, and then for another week, they celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they are not allowed to have any yeast in their houses during that time and eat only unleavened bread. Jews today still celebrate this, and it's called the Seder meal, and they continue to remember that memorial. It's probably one of the most significant still celebrations. So that was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That happened in the spring. We always equate that with, of course, Easter, which happens to be the week we're recording this. Right? And the reason for that is Jesus was killed on the Passover. And so we'll do a lot of those kind of connections and why that's important when we get next year to the Gospels. The second one was in the summer. It was the Feast of Weeks, also called the Grain Harvest or the Pentecost, which a lot of Christians know the Pentecost term. Pentecost was the Greek way of referring to this celebration. This one took place 50 days after after Passover. And it was a one-day harvest festival. So this is really the time that they would come back together just for one day to celebrate the beginnings of the harvest coming in 50 days after in the kind of end of summer. And they also equated this religiously to the giving of the covenant at Sinai. So the Pentecost became a time to come and reflect religiously on the giving of the law or the giving of the covenant. The third one was in the fall. It was called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. Now, this is interesting because last week in our episode, we talked about the tabernacle. So what is the Feast of Tabernacles? This was an eight-day celebration that came at the very end of the growing season. So once all the final fruit harvest came in, the vineyards were cleared, they would come together. And this was a time of great celebration, but it also was an anniversary of their beginnings of their wanderings in the wilderness. So they build tabernacles or booths or little tents, and they would celebrate that kind of time of God bringing them into the wilderness and their freedom. Fun little side story, when I lived in Naperville, Illinois, in the Chicago area, we had a Jewish neighbor who built a tabernacle out back of their house for the Feast of Tabernacles and invited us over, and we had dinner in their tabernacle for the Feast of Tabernacles. Yeah, it was fun.
That's crazy.
It was fun. So those are the three big ones.
Okay, that's helpful. You mentioned the Sabbath as being kind of a distinguishing mark of Israel compared to the nations surrounding them. And I'm curious if there's any other aspects of this culture that God's creating for Israel as being different or distinct from the cultures of the surrounding nations.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a both and thing. Like, some of the things were the same. The nations around them also celebrated agricultural moments, right? And so as we've already learned from even some of the creation stories and other accounts, is that Yahweh often takes what's happening around them and integrates these stories or practices into a different way of thinking about them. So we're now, even with these festivals, we're celebrating these important agricultural moments with thanksgiving to Yahweh and the important connection to his redemption and his providence and his, you know, the way he's blessed his people. So yeah, we do have that kind of, some things were similar, some things were very different. And certainly the most significant difference is monotheism, right? That Yahweh was the only God, the one God, the only God. And that was why he integrated these stories and made himself very different from the gods in which they worshiped.
I think it's good recognizing how different the culture of Israel was, and that kind of knowledge that reading the text will always be a cross-cultural experience is important, I think, to sit with. I've mentioned the book Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes before on the podcast. And I remember in the introduction, they gave an example of them asking two different groups of students to summarize the parable of the prodigal son. And they had a group of students from the West, a country in the West, and then another group from a country in Eastern Europe. And in the group from the West, they observed that no students mentioned the famine that occurs in the parable, whereas the other group that had come from a context that had recently experienced a famine in that country in their recent history, and all of those students mentioned it. And in the first group, there was a more of a focus on the irresponsibility of the younger son that kind of squandered his wealth and finally drove him to come back to his father. Whereas the second group, there was more a sense of the providence of God bringing about a famine that kind of drove the son to come home. And it made me realize, wow, how different it is, the context we're coming from and the cultures we're coming from when we even read the Bible, read the text. And I think something I took from that is just how important it is to read the Bible in community and with people from other backgrounds to us, and being able to come with different eyes to the text is really enriching, I think. And I think it's how God designed us to read it.
Totally agree. That's a great example. And I agree with your conclusion. I mean, this is why understanding other cultures is so critical to our own faith development and journey. Certainly of understanding Israel, very different place than what we live in today. But to your point, I think this is a great segue into our last point we want to talk about today, is our contemporary cultures and our spiritualities. And we've talked about this many times on this podcast, but you being from the UK, me being from the US, we have different experiences culturally, and that shapes our spirituality too. So we certainly don't experience the same culture Israel did. But Hannah, when you think about these key differences between Israel and today, if we're going to bring this into a contemporary context, what stands out to you?
Well, there are many, but one difference I think is key, coming from, I guess, the UK and the US in a way, and the most Western societies, I think we have cultures that are individualistic in nature, where the value is placed more on the autonomy of the individual. I think of all the Disney movies that had like a follow your heart message to them. Whereas I think in ancient Israel, and even the culture Jesus was born into in the Middle East, they are collectivist cultures in nature. So it's the community or the family or tribe is the most important and not the individual. When I heard someone distinguishing between those two, like individualist and collectivist cultures, by saying that conformity is a vice in the first, in the individualist culture, whereas it might be considered a virtue in a collectivist culture, which, it's a very different,
very different
place that we're coming from. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a great example. So part of what is important for us to recognize is, even in the last 500 years, how much culture has shifted. We have a cultural pluralism now that never existed before. So when you think about being part of Israel, everybody was part of Israel. Everyone had the same language, the same culture, the same food, the same symbols, the same religious practices. If you lived in France in the 1400s, everybody practiced the same religion, ate the same food, had the same culture, right? If you lived in Germany 500 years ago, same. I mean, and you even see this in the beginnings of the Reformation, that entire countries went certain directions religiously. Compared to, think about the pluralism in which we live now. From the UK, certainly the United States, I mean, the person across the street could be a different ethnicity. They could have a different language. They could make different foods in their home. They could practice different religion than you do. Mm. And that's a significant shift, right?
Yeah.
In how we integrate into society. So all of that affects culture and our cultural contexts. When we moved to South Africa, one of the things that was surprising to me coming in from America, they have 11 official languages there, right? Now, again, that's because of the modern way that we draw these geopolitical boundaries, because those languages have existed a lot longer than the country has. But now we draw these boundaries of a country and we say, you are South Africa, and you're bringing these languages and these cultures together. And that's a pluralism that we haven't had, you know, even a couple hundred years ago. So that's interesting. So why is culture so important for us to understand today? When you think about even the layers of culture that affect us. So in the United States, you have a national culture, being an American, but there's a lot of subcultures. And I know this is true in a lot of other countries as well. So like the state that you live in has a culture. We talk about Midwest culture or Texas culture. It certainly is a thing. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But, you know, East Coast culture, West Coast culture, that's all something to explore, as is the way that we're raised religiously, the music that we are taught to listen to as children, or that shape us, the foods that we eat, all of that affects us. So I know I talked a little bit about this before, but that move from Chicago to South Africa, it, you know, preparing for that move was a big thing, but then coming to Texas was a big thing because it's a very different culture. So Hannah, when you moved, I'm sure you experienced that, right? When you moved from the UK to Boston, I'm assuming you noticed some cultural differences. Did you?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny because there are so many cultures, it feels like, even within the UK. And of course, I'm mixed race, so there's cultures different. I have different relationships to different cultures, even in my own family. But yes, I think moving to America, I think there is a kind of, this was my experience, people have a boundless kind of optimism. People are very upbeat and charismatic. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just our rainy weather in the UK, we're more subdued. I remember watching a British comedian who said, who actually talked about this difference, and he said he thinks it's because of the tipping culture in the US, that maybe you're feeling like you need to be more upbeat. And he said that he preferred going to restaurants in the UK because the servers were miserable, but at least they were honest, is what he said.
Okay.
I think even when it comes to church, how we do church, I think we don't in the UK naturally heckle from the audience, but I think in America there's a lot more amens and awesomes that come from the audience, and maybe they're being imported over a bit more. But I remember being a student in London having to reassure a campus minister from America that we had enjoyed his sermon despite the silence from the audience. So yeah, but I think how that translated for me, because I might have said I was an extrovert in the UK, but I remember being an American feeling like maybe I'm a British extrovert and an American introvert. Just
wow.
That difference. So,
though that's interesting too, right? It even shapes the way we think about each other. Yeah, that's interesting. I told the story before on the podcast about moving to Texas, right? Just how difficult that was.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's part of what we have to think about and remember. You know, we like to in the church, I think sometimes we hold this idealism like, well, we're all equal at the foot of the cross and there's neither Jew nor Gentile. And yeah, that's true at one level, right? Yes, that's true. We all stand equal at the foot of the cross. There is no Jew, Gentile, male, you know, male or female, Greek or all that's true. But that does not erase culture. And culture shaping us and affecting us so much, it is important. And so I know that there's times I've done that really well, and there's times I've done that really poorly. And I think where we can do better, that we all are responsible for, is having a curiosity of being interested in each other, as opposed to being judgmental of things that are different from us, because that's sometimes our natural. And I think that's the culture of the world around us. They teach us to judge people who think differently, that process differently, that experience differently. And this is one of the things that as Christians has to be so deeply countercultural, that we don't meet different with judgment. We meet different with curiosity and interest. I think it also can feed into the sense of adventure and appreciation for each other, right? I don't think I've actually said this on the podcast. I've said this to you, but there's so many people that when I talk to you about the podcast now that are listening to the podcast and they go, oh, we really like Hannah. I'm like, thank Aww. You. Thank you. Like they're making it a point sure to say that they like Hannah, but they love your, you know, the age that you represent. They love the UK culture that you represent. They love the, but That's you nice. Do represent a different aspect of even our culture in our fellowship of churches that we're part of that is important, right? And so there's a recognition that, yeah, we even generationally see culture. And that's really important for us to, same thing. We've got to be curious and interested. We've got to lean in and appreciate that with each other.
Mm. Well, thank you for inviting me, Dave. It also takes that invitation into dialogue with those from different generations, as you said, or demographics. And I love that call to curiosity you mentioned. That was something else I put in my article because I felt like that's so crucial when it comes to understanding or how we should relate to those that are different from us. When I think about kind of some practicals when it comes to kind of this idea of culture and different cultures, I would definitely recommend if people have the means to travel to do that and get to experience even church in another country. Because I think we can be so immersed in our own cultural context that we can start to think this is how everyone does things, or this is how everyone does church, or this is how everyone reads their Bible. And anytime I've been able to do that, it's been incredibly enriching, as well as great for my humility, just to see there's not one way of doing things. And sometimes it might not even require traveling. I spent a year in the Spanish region of my church in Boston. Right. So it's the same building, but it's the Spanish congregation. And learned so much from the way they prayed, the way they did worship, the sense of family that I still carry with me now. So, yeah. Those are some thoughts I have.
It's good. I love that. So this is actually the end of a new series here, Hannah. We just finished episode 26. We are wrapping up the series, God's Nation Formed. And it's hard to believe we're done with the Torah already. So we've moved through all five books of the Torah, the Pentateuch, the Law. So we now move into this next, in our next episode, God's Nation Established. We're going to be crossing into the Promised Land.
Yay. And
yeah.
Yay. Finally.
We're coming out of the wilderness and into the Promised Land. This series will be, yeah, this series will be a little bit shorter. It's only going to be four episodes. We have two guests for this next series. We're going to have Dr. Michael Burns join us, which will be great. Talking about coming into the Promised Land and the Book of Judges. And well, I'm not sure at what point he'll join us, but that'll be a good guest to have. And then the soon to be, maybe in the next couple of years, Dr. Cherie Gale. So Cherie's one of our PhD students who's at Georgetown, and she's going to come and join us for this episode on Ruth, which will be a really great conversation to talk about Ruth and the Book of Ruth. So that is to come. So, Hannah, we're done with another series. Congratulations.
Yay. We made it. And thank you all for listening this far.
Thank you for listening this far. We'll see you next episode.
See you then. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining this Thread conversation.
We're more than a podcast. Check out threadpodcast.org for more immersive content.
Though I'm waiting on here, I get a better view of this boundless world.